Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in the state of Michigan against Long. It's amazing that the first 10 minutes of the playground, he could have done that. The first 10 minutes of the playground, he's done that. He mentions his rather astonishing result from the historical thing. Mr. Solicitor General, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this case involves the validity of a warrantless search of a respondent and the auto passenger part of the automobile under his control and possession prior to his arrest for possession of marijuana and of the automobile trunk after his arrest. The two deputy sheriffs were driving south on a county road in a rural area at midnight, and the car that the sheriffs were driving was passed by another automobile going in the opposite direction and was clocked by a radar device at 71 miles an hour in a 55-mile-hour zone. The car was pursued by the two deputy sheriffs. The pursuit, in about 5 or 10 minutes, they lost sight of the vehicle for approximately 5 or 10 minutes. They did notice the taillight go left off of the road that they were on, and as they made the turn left to follow the car, they found the car in the ditch. The front end of the car was in the ditch. The rear end was sticking out over the portion of the traveled road. The entire incident lasted about 5 minutes. There was no other traffic that was noticed in the area. The police car approached the car in the ditch on the passenger side, and they saw a respondent seated in the driver's side of the automobile behind the wheel and was the only occupant. Respondent exited the automobile, leaving the driver's side door wide open with a dome light on, and met the two police officers at the rear of the automobile. At that time, one of the deputies asked the respondent for his driver's license. The deputy did not, or the respondent did not respond. He didn't say a word. He stared. And he was asked a second time by the deputy to produce his driver's license. After a few seconds, he reached in his wallet on his person and produced the driver's license. Secondly, the deputy sheriff asked the respondent for the certificate of registration. And this is required to be produced upon demand under the Michigan Vehicle Code. Again, there was no response, and a few moments of staring, and the second time he was asked for the registration. At that time, the respondent made a move toward the open door on the driver's side of the car. One of the deputies was behind respondent, and the other deputy was at his side. At the time they approached the door, the deputy saw a knife, a large folded knife, in plain view on the floorboard in the driver's side next to the door that was open and in front of the front seat of the car. Upon seeing that knife, the deputy sheriff, one of the deputies, said, "Hold it." And he was then moved toward the rear of the car at the side window, and with his hands on the roof of the car, he was patted down by one of the deputies. The other deputy, at that point in time, looked into the car. He didn't enter it. He took his flashlight, he flashed in the interior of the car, and as he did that, he noticed the armrest. The car, the front seat's divided by an armrest, divided in half. He noticed something protruding from underneath the armrest. At that point in time, he knelt in and again examined it more closely, and he flipped up one side of the armrest. As he flipped up the one side of the armrest, he noticed that this was a pouch of a sort that was open. He didn't touch it. He flashed the light on the on the object and more close examination, he noticed that there was a plastic baggie sticking out of the pouch. And out of the plastic baggie in full view, without touching it, he noticed a substance that appeared to him to be marijuana. At that point in time, he picked up the pouch, he felt it with his hands, and he felt another hard object in that pouch. He opened it up and he noticed that the bottle had a powdery substance and there was a pill of some sort that was wrapped up in tin foil. At that point in time, the deputy sheriff says, I'm arresting you for grass, for possession of marijuana.
Mr. Caruso,
yes?
Do you think that the officers could have arrested the defendant in this case for speeding or for driving while intoxicated or perhaps even for carrying the weapon which they found?
I believe that at that time a violation of the Michigan Vehicle Code
before
for speeding.
Before all this search
yes.
occurred.
Yes. He could have been arrested. It could have been a custodial arrest because violation of speed limit is a misdemeanor.
But it's your position, or you would concede, that that didn't occur. They
that
didn't
did
make
not occur. As a matter
arrest,
of practice, they do
have.
Not arrest for speeding violations unless it's something more in
How
addition to
How about driving
it.
While intoxicated? They don't take somebody into custody for that?
Well, they would
Michigan.
Have to go through a process to make a determination as to whether the party is intoxicated and then go from that point. But at this particular point in time, they didn't know really what they had. They noticed a car in the ditch. They had an unresponsive individual and who appeared to be under the influence of something. And they wanted to determine whether the registration to the vehicle was in the car or on his person as required by the Motor Vehicle Code. At the time, they patted him down. At the time that they saw the large knife they picked up and they found the pouch and this sort of thing, they charged him and they arrested him, and then they asked for the key because one of the deputies who looked inside had noticed that the car was in the lock position, the driving mechanism, and there wasn't any key in the ignition. He did give one key, and then he said at that time, the respondent, that he did not have a key to the trunk. So the deputy walked around back of the trunk, and he noticed when he looked at the lock of the trunk, the lock had been punched out. There wasn't a lock there. And he was able to open up the trunk by simply inserting a small penknife that triggered the mechanism and opened up the trunk. And when he looked into the trunk, he found two large sacks, and they were split open. It was a large sack split open into two sections, which appeared to him to contain, again, marijuana, later found out to be about 70 to 75 pounds of contraband marijuana. At that time, they patted him down a second time, they handcuffed him, and took him back to the cruiser and called in a wrecker to have the car towed into the sheriff's department to secure the vehicle and to bring the respondent to jail. Now, it is our position, the state's position here, that the frisk of respondent in the interior of the automobile under these circumstances is justified by the rationale of Terry v. Ohio. Although Terry allowed an encroachment on the privacy rights of an individual for the protection of police officers, the frisk in Terry was for weapons that was and was confined to the pat down of the individual's outer clothing. Here, the search for weapons was not limited to the frisk of respondent, but extended into the passenger part of the automobile. And as stated in Adams v. Williams, the whole purpose of the Terry search is not to discover evidence of crime, but rather to allow a police officer to conduct an investigation without fear of personal injury.
Mr. Caruso, would you address the question of whether there's an adequate and independent state ground in this case? There's some indication that Michigan imposes a higher standard for illegal search and seizure cases than the federal constitution would require.
The Supreme Court in its decision that reversed the Court of Appeals made a reference to Article 1, Section 11 of the Michigan Constitution, but did not discuss it at any time in the opinion. The decision was made on the basis of the Fourth Amendment. And so I would say, in chief, they discussed only federal cases dealing with the Fourth Amendment.
Well, they cited the Michigan Constitution.
They did cite the
Michigan. And the cases and statutes in Michigan and the Michigan Constitution, in fact, require a higher standard in this circumstance than would be required by the federal Constitution.
In People v. Moore, in Michigan case, it was held that the particular clause in the Michigan Constitution which permits the introduction to evidence of evidence sought found that is not subject to the strict requirement of reasonable search and seizure is inconsistent with the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution, and therefore it doesn't obtain and it doesn't endure. And so in this particular case, it was not decided on the basis of that clause in the Michigan Constitution, which permits a greater latitude in the search for evidence in connection with narcotics or criminal automobile.
Well, I'm not sure I understand your answer. If the Michigan Supreme Court were to apply Michigan law, would it reach the result you're asking us to reach under
yes.
the federal constitution?
Yes, it would. Yes, it would.
And it would allow, in your opinion, clearly, a Terry-type search
yes,
of the auto interior.
Yes, it would allow a Terry-type search. Yes, it would.
And you base that on what?
I base that on the proposition that the Michigan case law, with reference to the reasonableness of a search, really relates to the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. And repeatedly, these cases that have permitted searches of this type have relied upon the Terry rationale.
May I ask you if you're familiar with the case of People against Sechrest, a 1982 Michigan case which relied only on the Michigan Constitution?
I'm not that familiar with it, no, Mr. Justice.
Do you have an explanation of why in this particular case, the Michigan court specifically said it relied on the Michigan Constitution if it didn't mean that?
I think it was just simply just added to it. It's just an afterthought.
Didn't Justice Coleman in her dissent also say there was no violation of the Michigan Constitution in her view? She thought it necessary to address the Michigan Constitution as well as the majority.
Well, she did find that there's not necessarily any violation of the Michigan Constitution, but just a statement in that sense. And in the majority opinion that reversed the Court of Appeals really discussed the Michigan Constitution. It simply relied on all of the cases, citing all the cases, analyzing the cases that dealt with the United States Constitution.
Of course, but it did squarely say we find that there's a violation of the Michigan
Constitution.
Yes, Mr.
Justice, it did.
And is it not true that the text of the Michigan constitutional provision is rather different from the text of the Fourth Amendment?
There is a clause added to that that is totally different than the Fourth Amendment, Mr. Justice. That is correct.
Mr. Solicitor General, you several times say the Terry-type search of the automobile. There was no automobile in Terry.
No, there wasn't, and this is what we're asking the court to do.
Why do you keep saying Terry-type search of an automobile?
Well, I say that to frisk or search the automobile based upon the Terry rationale. It is not a Terry-type search of an automobile. The Terry-type search I have reference to in using that that phrase is reference to a protective search for the protection of the police officer. As I indicated in the Terry case,
well,
he put
him up against the side of the car.
Pardon?
He put the man up against the side of the car and patted him down. That's a Terry search.
That is a Terry search.
Well, then you went further. You went in the trunk. You went every place in the world except the tires.
Well, we're asking that the Terry rationale
be extended
to go into the passenger compartment of an automobile, because under the totality of the facts in this case, we feel that the police officers were justified in continuing the search into the passenger compartment of the automobile.
What about Belton and Robbins and the cases that came after this case was decided?
Well, in those cases, I don't recall that really involved a protective search for the benefit of police officers.
Well, but I'm speaking of the examination of the trunk.
Oh, the examination
of the
trunk.
Stopped,
oh, yes, I would say.
He was lawfully arrested, was he not?
Yes. Forgetting the interior of the car and confining to the search of the trunk after arrest, I would say that today it would be governed by probable cause search based on Ross and based on Michigan v. Thomas and also based upon the Belton case, a search incident to arrest. In this case, we relied on it, as indicated by the question presented in the brief, upon the rationale of Opperman. But any one of those cases would apply to the trunk search today. There isn't any question about it, in my opinion. But here, we're confining my remarks for the moment to the search of the interior of the car after the knife was found is based upon the Terry rationale, if you please. The Terry rationale had to do with an investigatory, legitimate investigatory search. And the police officer in this case had found himself in a legitimate, confrontive, investigative search for speeding and for a car in the ditch. And the petitioner suggests, considering the totality of the facts, that it was at nighttime, in a rural area, an unresponsive individual who would not respond, who made a move toward the open door of the car and found, and there was a knife in plain view. I think that all of these factors gave rise to an articulable suspicion that would justify a fear and a concern in these two police officers. Both of these officers had considerable experience. One of them had had 8 years' service in the deputy as a deputy sheriff and 3 years in the police department for the city of Detroit. The other had had some experience and training in the Justice Department. And both of these people have testified, it's very clear from the record, that they were concerned at all time during the course of the so-called ongoing investigation. And as I submit that the patting down of respondent and then taking that search from respondent into the car under these facts and circumstances is part and parcel of a continuous investigation in one incident. In addition to that, the reason that the police officer indicated that he wanted to go in the car to examine the interior of the car, he had not yet received the certificate of registration. He was going to allow the respondent to go into the car. He testified to that, to get that registration of the automobile, even after he had found the knife and secured the knife. He went back in there to see if there were any further weapons so that respondent could go back into the car to see if he could produce that certificate of registration. But, of course, at that point in time, they lifted the armrest, they found the marijuana, and the arrest was made on that basis. And the area that was searched was an area that has to do in which there is no great expectation of privacy. It's under the armrest. It's an area that could conceal a weapon. As I say, that the officers were bent on a very limited intrusion. The officer was looking only for weapons because he intended to let respondent back into the car. Now, insofar as the case law on this is concerned, in Pennsylvania v. Mims, this court gave recognition to the great danger that surrounds an investigative stop by a police officer to the extent that he is permitted to order the driver out of the car. And if a police officer orders a driver out of the car, it's for safety purposes, and of course if nothing is wrong, then he goes back into the car. But if there are Terry factors that come into being, as in this case, the finding of the knife, under these totality of circumstances, then, of course, a search of the interior of the car before letting him back in is justified. It's justified under the reasoning of Pennsylvania v. Mims. It's justified under the reasoning of the Terry case. And the alternative would have been, suggested by Justice O'Connor, the officer could have made a custodial arrest. But they don't do these things unless they absolutely have to. But at this point in time, when they observed the person, they were still in the investigative process that was ongoing to try to determine just what they had here, a speedster, an unresponsive person, and here you have a car in the ditch. Now, the search after arrest would be justified under Opperman because there is certainly isn't any pretext involved in this case, because the inventory search was made at the scene. It was made at the scene after the arrest had been made, and certainly it would be justified in this case. Unlike Opperman, a car was taken in because of the multiple traffic at parking tickets that the party had had. In this particular case, an arrest has been made on the scene and on the spot. And in addition to that, as I say, I believe that the case is also governed by these more recent decisions, particularly by Michigan v. Thomas.
May I ask you, Mr. Solicitor General, one other question about our jurisdiction? The case of People Against Sechrest that I asked you about earlier says in words that the state constitution imposes a higher standard of protection than does the federal constitution, and that the federal cases are merely instructive in analyzing it. If that is a correct statement of Michigan law, do you think we have jurisdiction of this appeal?
Yes, I do. I do believe that you have jurisdiction under this in this case, simply because the court did apply down below, and the court did apply in the Court of Appeals the Fourth Amendment and the case law, the U.S. case law, pursuant under the Fourth Amendment, with reference there too, to wit, specifically the Terry case.
You'd say that's true, even if Michigan imposes a tougher standard than the federal government.
Even if Michigan imposes a tougher standard, yes.
Well, suppose the court had started out and said we're interested in deciding whether there was a illegal search under the Michigan Constitution, and then said it might help us to decide that by talking about the federal law, and they did. Then they made went through exactly the same discussion of the federal law, and then said, as they said, we therefore conclude that the search violated the Fourth Amendment and the Michigan Constitution.
Well, under the decision of I believe it's Delaware versus Prowse, I believe that we had a similar circumstance here before the court. Even though it could have been decided on the state constitution, was also decided on the federal constitution, the court retained jurisdiction of that matter.
And suppose it's clear that the state, as Justice Stevens suggests, doesn't necessarily follow the, in applying its own constitution, doesn't necessarily follow or feel compelled by the federal rulings, have their own view of their own constitution. That wasn't the case in Delaware.
I don't believe it was the case here, Your Honor. I think, Mr. Justice, I think in this case what they did, they really applied the Fourth Amendment. Now, insofar as the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and the Michigan Constitution, they're almost identical in content, except for that final clause. And it says the provisions of this section shall not be construed to bar from evidence in any criminal proceedings, any narcotic drug, firearm, bomb, explosive, or any other dangerous weapon seized by a peace officer outside the curtilage of any dwelling house in the state. And this provision, our courts have said, matched against the Fourth Amendment, has no effect.
Well, Mr. Stowers is going to have the lectern next. Strauss.
And Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, New York against Belton presented circumstances similar to those involved here. Suspects were stopped on the highway, they got out of their car, and the police officer subsequently looked into the interior of the car. The Court in Belton held that the importance of protecting an officer's safety and the need for clear, understandable standards required a bright-line rule that an officer may conduct a search incident to arrest in such circumstances. The court specifically did not inquire into the factors that respondent and the Michigan Supreme Court would apparently make decisive here, such factors as the precise positioning of the officers and the suspects at the scene, or whether there were alternative means available that the officer might have used to control the suspect.
Well, the Belton rule doesn't accrue until there's been an arrest.
That's right. It deals with searches incident to arrest, Justice White, and this case only involves a protective search for weapons incident to a Terry stop.
Well, if this gentleman had tried to walk away shortly after the police got there, but before there was anything said about an arrest, what would have happened to him, in your view?
The officer testified, I believe, that he would not have allowed him to walk away.
So that under what we've said many times, if he can't walk away, he's under arrest.
Well, he's not necessarily under arrest. In this case, I think we fairly clearly have a stop as opposed to an arrest. The officer also testified that he did not place him under arrest until he had seen the marijuana. But in many ways, a stop in which a suspect is not placed under arrest and in which the officers often are at the scene with a suspect for an extended period to question him is an even more volatile and dangerous situation for an officer than one in which a suspect has been fully subdued and arrested.
The search of the trunk came some significant time after the bag of marijuana was discovered on the front seat. Is that not so?
That's right. The search of the trunk followed the discovery of the marijuana and the arrest. And the search of the trunk, in our view, could have been justified under Belton as a search incident to arrest.
I thought Belton was passenger compartment.
That it was, Justice Rehnquist, but in this case we have an unlocked trunk.
So you say that can be treated like the passenger?
That's at least as accessible to the suspect as the passenger compartment.
Assume they discovered the marijuana in the passenger compartment and they arrest. Wouldn't that give a probable cause to search the entire car?
I think that certainly would give probable
cause
to search the
car. Under Belton. Not necessarily under Belton.
If under Ross would give probable cause to search the entire car, they could at that point have searched the entire car as a probable cause search as well as a search incident to arrest under Belton.
Exactly.
But the initial discovery of the marijuana was the result of what one might call a car frisk, a search for weapons only in the car.
And after that, it was no frisk.
Once they found the marijuana, that's right, they placed them under arrest.
They could have handcuffed it.
That's right.
And he could have heard whom then.
They did.
In fact, they did at some point at least place him in the
cruiser. They could have done it before they searched the trunk. And they wouldn't have had to search the trunk to find whether there were weapons in it.
That's right. The search, no one, so far as I know, Justice Marshall, defends the trunk search as a car frisk, as a search for weapons. That's a search incident to arrest or arguably a probable cause search. At least a search incident to arrest in the Belton because he was under arrest at that point.
I remember it was one officer and three men or something. This is two officers with one man.
I believe those are the facts of Belton, Justice Marshall.
Well, I think that two officers ought to be able to take care of one man.
Well, that's precisely the sort of thing, Justice Marshall, that the court in Belton refused to inquire into, and I think that's exactly the sort of thing that it's very dangerous for a court to try to reassess after the fact, to go back and to say, Well, when the officers are acting with a reasonable apprehension of danger, as no one seems to deny that they had here, and take a step precisely analogous to what the court said they could take in Belton, in a situation that is, as I said, even more dangerous than the Belton situation, because the suspect is not arrested, he's not in handcuffs, he's not held at gunpoint or locked into the back of the car.
But he was told, whoa, and he stopped.
He was told to stop, and his hands were placed on the roof of the car. But the fact remains that the officers had reason to believe something that wasn't present in Belton. Here there was reason to believe that there was a dangerous weapon in the car that could have been obtained by the suspect and used against the officers.
Mr. Strauss, if the court were to adopt this wingspan approach to a Terry search, does the expanded search of the interior of the car of necessity involve a more extensive search than would be the case for a pat-down of an individual, where we've said you just pat them down and see if they're weapons? To search the interior of the car, are you talking about a more detailed sort of a search, going in the glove compartment and actually looking around, lifting up the bar in the middle between the seats and that kind of thing?
It's an analogous search, Justice O'Connor.
Would you
it's
concede search- that it would, of necessity, be more extensive than the pat-down that we approved in Terry?
It would be a search for weapons, and it couldn't reach places where a weapon could not be concealed or from which it could not be obtained. For example, they couldn't do what the officers did in Carroll and rip open the seats.
Yeah, but I assume in a Terry pat-down, we have not at least said, I think, that you can pull out a little marijuana baggie, if that's what it feels like. All you can pull out is a weapon. Now, in a search for the weapons in the interior of a car, you're arguing that you could pull out the baggie of marijuana.
If in the course of a pat-down an officer were to find an unidentifiable by touch, hard object beneath the outer clothing of the suspect, yes, he certainly could reach in, pull it out, and take a look at it, which is all that Deputy Howell
did. But not a marijuana cigarette or a little baggie or something of that sort,
If it were something that didn't feel like a weapon from the outside, that's right. And that would be the same principle that would limit this sort of search. In fact, it is sort of limited search, weapon search. In fact, it seems fairly clear that an inspection for weapons in the inside of a car, whereas the court has held the expectation of privacy is less, and many parts of which are visible from the outside by any passerby, is a good deal less intrusive than having an officer actually lay his hands in the suspect's body, as the court described.
Well, it may be less intrusive in a personal sense, but you may be able to get more objects and make a more thorough search. Would you agree if you were to extend the doctrine?
I think the limiting principle is exactly the same, Justice O'Connor. You can look for obtainable weapons and nothing more, but of course nothing less if the officer's safety is to be protected. I think the other difficulty with the approach of the Michigan Supreme Court and of respondent, in addition to increasing the uncertainty and danger faced by law enforcement officers, is that it would have the effect of imposing much greater burdens on suspects and of impairing values related to the Fourth Amendment. That's because if an officer concerned about his safety is unsure of his authority to conduct this sort of car frisk, a limited search for weapons, he will be forced to take other highly intrusive actions, such as handcuffing the suspect or locking him in the police car for the duration of the stop, or possibly even holding him at gunpoint during the stop. And surely most suspects will consider these to be far more humiliating and unsettling actions than a limited weapons inspection of a car. But if respondent prevails, a prudent officer concerned about both his own safety and the dictates of the Fourth Amendment will have no alternative to taking these actions. Similarly, and Justice O'Connor alluded to this point earlier, an officer with probable cause to arrest the suspect often will merely stop him and ask him questions to see if there is some exculpatory explanation. But if the consequence, and that way he can avoid an unnecessary arrest, but if the consequence of stopping a suspect instead of arresting him is that there is some question about the officer's ability to protect his own safety, then of course the officer simply will not hesitate to make an arrest and conduct the complete search and undoubtedly more intrusive search incident to arrest that Belton gives him the right to conduct.
Yet, do you think that Belton applies where the search is not a custodial arrest, or where the arrest is not a custodial arrest?
I'm not sure.
Search incident in Robinson and Gustafson applies only to custodial arrests. Do you think Belton nonetheless applies across the board?
I'm not sure I understand the difference between custodial arrests and other sorts of arrests.
Well, I think that a custodial arrest is where the police plan to take the person arrested into custody, as opposed to simply give him a ticket.
If they don't plan to take him and remove him from the scene subsequent to the arrest, I think there is some question from the face of the Belton opinion whether Belton applies to such. So here, of course, we have a stop on the scene, and where the suspect and the officers are in continuous contact on the scene, and the officers' exposure to danger and exposure to hidden weapons is to that extent.
Is the crucial question whether they do in fact intend to take him into custody, or whether they are lawfully authorized to do it, whether they do or do not take him into custody?
Well, for purposes of what happened in this case, even if there were certainly no probable cause and no grounds to take him into custody and only reasonable suspicion to stop him, they would be authorized in taking these limited measures necessary to protect their safety.
Isn't it true that custody is always taken when you arrest a person? How can you arrest somebody and not take him into custody?
Well, that's why I asked Justice Rehnquist the question. I don't know of any constitutional limitation in this Court's opinions.
I mean, if it's an arrest, by hypothesis, he's in custody. Isn't that right?
It's a matter of definitions, Justice Stevens.
And then he may be released on a sort of, quote, parole to drive his own car home if he's not drunk or if he's not injured. But as Justice Stevens suggested, he has been arrested as soon as his liberty has been detained or interfered with. Is that not so?
Certainly it would be an odd result if the officers have probable cause to arrest him. It would be an odd result to say that if they want to conduct a search incident to arrest, they must also take him into custody, even in circumstances where they would otherwise be inclined for perhaps to take bail from him on the spot, if that's a permissible procedure in the state. Thank you.
Counsel, you may proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This is a state's rights case as well as a search and seizure case, and I think that the questions that were asked of Mr. Caruso about the independent state ground for the decision were appropriate. This Court faced the same issue in City of Mesquite versus Aladdin's Castle, a case in which seven justices agreed. In that case, it was argued that the Texas Constitution provided an independent ground for the Court of Appeals judgment, and this Court determined that because that possible ground for the judgment existed, this Court lacked jurisdiction to decide whether or not the lower court had made an error in interpreting federal constitutional law. Justice Stevens has asked about the case of Michigan versus Sechrest. It was reported in volume 413 of the Michigan Reports, the same volume that this case was reported in. It's current Michigan law, and the Michigan Supreme Court plainly and unmistakably said that the Michigan Constitution, Article 1, Section 11, provides a higher standard than that is the standard provided by the state constitution. Michigan has had a long history of providing greater protection to citizens under the state constitution than under the federal constitution.
Well, but if that's true, as I don't doubt it is, if you say it is, how does that apply to this particular case where the Supreme Court of Michigan simply mentions the state constitution in a part of a sentence, and all of its analysis is in terms of the federal constitution?
They only mentioned the federal constitution in part of his sentence. They mentioned the state constitution three times.
But all the cases are federal cases.
Well, the case was Terry versus Ohio. They talked about Canal Zone versus Bender, and they also mentioned People versus Reed, which was a Michigan case. They cited that in a footnote, and People versus Reed was based on the Michigan constitution as well as the federal constitution. But the point I was making about People versus Sechrest is in that case, the court says that they use federal cases, like Terry versus Ohio, as a guide, but they don't feel bound by federal cases in ruling on questions of Michigan
constitutional law. Can you give us any reason why they didn't say just that?
I don't think they regarded it as necessary. I think that they meant what they said when they said it.
Didn't we ask them?
Beg your pardon?
Didn't we ask them the question?
No, this court has never asked the Michigan Supreme Court in this case. I think you can remand
it. It comes up every other week.
That's true.
I mean,
under California versus Scribd, I think you can remand it.
Don't they know that the only thing they have to do is to say this is being decided on the Constitution of the State of Michigan, period?
They didn't say that. They said it was
being decided. Couldn't they have said it?
Yes, they could have.
And that would have been the end of the case, wouldn't it?
I believe it would have been.
Well, how do we persuade them to say whether they do one or the other?
Tell them.
I see.
I think that's been done on a number of occasions.
I wish that they had decided it solely on Michigan constitutional grounds, but evidently the court felt that the search was barred, and as I feel, the search was barred under both the federal and state grounds.
But if, as Justice Marshall has suggested, if the state constitution affords an adequate ground, why isn't that the end of the case? Or is the court trying to share the burden with the federal constitution?
It's difficult. I can't read the minds of the justices of the Michigan Supreme Court, of course. They've given no indication that they intend to share any burden. They've said quite explicitly in a great number of cases that they regard the Michigan Constitution.
Well, we've reversed them often enough that they ought to get the signal.
There are many cases where you haven't reversed them. There are many cases where certiorari has been denied, where they've decided cases on both state and federal constitutional grounds.
I suppose those reversals just confirm your view that Michigan takes a broader view of the protections provided by its by the Fourth Amendment and its Constitution.
I believe that it does, and I've mentioned in my brief some of the a few of the many instances where Michigan does take a broader view of citizens' rights under the state Constitution than exist under the federal Constitution. Getting to the question of whether or not the so-called protective search of the car violated the federal Constitution, I think that the Michigan Supreme Court has recently shown that it recognizes a difference between the cases that are cited in the dissent in the Michigan Supreme Court and this sort of a case, where there was no articulable facts to which the officers could point to demonstrate danger. Chief Justice Coleman, in her dissent, listed a great many decisions from other jurisdictions and where searches of automobiles were upheld, and I suggested in our brief that those cases were distinguishable on their facts. Well, 2 days before Christmas, the Michigan Supreme Court decided People versus Esters and upheld a warrantless search of an automobile on facts very similar to many of the cases cited by Justice Coleman in her dissent. In People versus Esters, a dry cleaning establishment was held up, and a young boy who saw the crime take place wrote down the license number of the car that was involved and gave a description of the car and a description of the robber. Within minutes, the police had located the car, found it in a driveway. The license matched the description that was given. There were wet tire tracks coming from the road into the driveway, and there were wet footprints from the car into the house. They went into the house, arrested the defendant who matched the description given by the witness, went out into the driveway and searched the car and found a pistol that matched the description of the pistol that was used in the robbery. And of the six justices of the Michigan Supreme Court who decided that case, five wrote on the question of whether or not the search was lawful, and five said that it was. And I think that People versus Esters is like Minnesota versus Gilchrist and Updegraff versus Alaska and U.S. versus Paulus and all the other cases cited by Justice Coleman in her dissent, cases where the police officers had some specific reason to believe that the defendant was dangerous, as in the Updegraff versus Alaska was almost identical on its facts to People versus Esters. In Paulus, the police had received radio information describing a van that was alleged to have been occupied by armed men, one of whom had an outstanding arrest warrant on it. It was headed towards an Indian reservation where there had been some shootings within a few days. Some of the other cases that are mentioned in the brief are quite similar, Massachusetts versus Alameda. They're all cases in which the police had some reason to believe that a violent crime either had been just committed or was about to be committed. And you contrast that case with this one, where the police officers never testified that they regarded Mr. Long as dangerous. You won't find the word dangerous in any of the transcripts. They never said they feared for their safety. The most that either of the deputies was willing to say is that they were not unconcerned about Mr. Long. Well, one deputy said that I didn't completely ignore him. That was the extent of his concern about Mr. Long. Mr. Long was cooperative. He did everything the officers asked. He headed for the car because they asked him to go to the car and get the registration.
Do you feel that the articulable suspicion in cases turn on the subjective impressions of the particular officers involved rather than kind of an objective standard?
I think it's a difficult mix of objective standards and subjective factors. I think if the officer does not have a subjective belief that he should be in fear for his own safety, even if some person might, on the basis of the same facts, say there was an objective basis for searching, I don't think that he could.
Do you think our cases support you in that? They refer to articulable suspicion, and it seems to me that at least some of them don't focus on subjective.
Terry discusses the officer's well-founded belief of fear for his own safety, and that's why I say I think it's a difficult mix. I think as a minimum, I think if the officer held an unreasonable belief that his own safety was in danger, that the search wouldn't be justified.
Yes, I think that's probably right, but I'm not sure that the cases support you in requiring both an objective and subjective belief.
Even if that's a given, I think that the objective facts that were here, there were very little to distinguish this case from most traffic stops in Michigan.
Well, how about the knife on the floorboard? Does that happen every time you have a traffic stop in Michigan?
No, the knife was not contraband. It was a legal knife, and as I mentioned in my brief, there are a great many lawful articles that are commonly possessed in cars in Michigan and elsewhere that would present at least as much harm to the deputies as this knife did. The deputies ignored a screwdriver that was in the car in their search for weapons. They ignored a hammer. There's a Michigan case where I cited in my brief where a traffic detainee returned to his car and used the car to assault the officer. I think literally, if there's a traffic stop and the justification for the so-called search or protective frisk of the car is that the detainee might return to the car and use something in it or the car itself to injure the officer, then as a practical matter, you're saying that any detainee, traffic detainee that stopped, is going to have his car searched.
Well, is that all bad when you're talking about a search for weapons?
I personally don't believe this was a search for weapons, as evidenced by the fact that the officers never treated the defendant as a dangerous person and ignored very obvious tools that could have been used to hurt themselves and instead concentrated on a billfold.
Well, but that isn't the ground that the Supreme Court of Michigan went off on, that it really wasn't a search for
weapons. No, they did not say that. They assumed that it was a protective search. And the answer to your question is yes, I think it would be bad. I think that the framers of the Constitution had in mind the dangers of police work when they drafted the Fourth Amendment. They had long experience with smugglers, with the efforts of British revenue officers to enforce tax laws with writs of assistance, and they knew that people sometimes violently resisted the efforts of police to enforce the law, and they still passed the Fourth Amendment. And I think that
the question is whether the Fourth Amendment prohibits this.
Exactly so. I think that this case is much more like Cibron versus New York than it is like Terry versus Ohio. In Cibron, you'll recall, the court said that a police officer couldn't just start searching for evidence. They had to have some indication that at least that he was actually searching for weapons. As I just mentioned in this case, the officers gave every indication that they weren't searching for weapons. They ignored the most obvious things in the car that were in plain view that could have been used as weapons, the screwdriver and the hammer, and instead concentrated on a small leather object that was small enough to be placed in the deputy's back pocket, which is where he put it after he picked it up.
What did they do with the knife?
I wish I knew. We can't find the knife. As far as I'm concerned, it still belongs to Mr. Long. The one deputy who went to the car first picked it up and actually held it in his hand while the other deputy frisked Mr. Long, and then I believe one of the deputies put the knife in his pocket. It was not returned to Mr. Long, and it was not put in the car. It was used in evidence at the trial. But I don't know where the knife is now. I'd like to point out that Mr. Long was cooperative at all times. He did everything the officers asked. They described him as cooperative. He was not belligerent.
Well, does the record show where he was going when he turned around and walked that way?
Not very clearly. He was still not at the doorway.
But he was. They had asked him for his registration statement, which he didn't have. Is it clear enough that he was headed back to get it?
He didn't say anything. He started towards the doorway.
What did the officers say that they anticipated that he was going to go back into the car to hunt for the registration statement to see if he had one?
My recollection of their testimony is that they made no assumption as to what he was doing, just described his acts rather than they didn't say what they thought he was about.
I understood from your colleague that the testimony of the officer was that they thought he was going back to the car to find the registration statement.
Well, I can't complain. They had just asked him for the registration statement. That's the only logical explanation, but I can't recall anything in the record where the deputies specifically testified that they thought that's what Mr. Long was doing.
You normally
keep
that. You normally, sometimes people keep them in their glove compartment.
As a matter of fact, they never did get the registration papers for this particular car. They found a paper that showed the car was titled in someone else's name, but the two different documents, they never did get the registration paper. You might point out that under Michigan law, even if he refused, if he said, no, I won't produce the registration paper, they wouldn't have been entitled to make a custodial arrest. People versus Marshall, People versus 7th District Judge. I mean, he's required to carry it, but they can give him an appearance ticket for not having his registration. They can't take him into custody. And contrary to what Mr. Caruso said, even at the time of this traffic offense, they could not have made a custodial arrest for speeding under the Michigan Motor Vehicle Act. The citation is in the brief. It's MCLA 257, I think it's 727. They're required to give an appearance ticket unless there are some facts that weren't present here.
And what do they call it in Michigan when you stop a fellow for speeding and insist that he stay there until he gets a ticket? That's just a...
It's a traffic stop
and detention for the purpose of giving a ticket.
I think it'd be pretty clear that he's not arrested, as Michigan courts use that word. Yeah. If they had arrested him, they'd have to comply with the Michigan Interim Bail Act, which would have given him an opportunity to post bond before they could have given him the intensive sort of search that they would have done before they admitted him to a jail. I think there are lots of state law reasons why they could not have taken Mr. Long into custody.
Or his car.
I think that there was even less justification for taking his car and impounding. They didn't have to impound his car. They wanted to impound his car.
Even after they found marijuana in the car?
I think that's correct. They could have taken the marijuana and left the car. And if they had, it's important to remember that they never tried to justify the search of the trunk as either a search incident to arrest or as a probable cause search. If they tried that,
I know they didn't. But let's assume we disagree
with
you.
They would have lost as a matter of state law had they made that argument.
Let's assume that we disagree with you, and that the looking under the armrest was defensible and was not unreasonable, and that finding the initial bag of marijuana was defensible. And suppose he had been arrested right then, could they have searched the trunk?
Well, we would lose under U.S. versus Ross and New York versus.
Yeah, you would lose under federal law.
And I think we'd win under People versus Hilbert, which is Michigan law, which was exactly that case. They found marijuana in the passenger compartment, wanted to search the trunk, and the Michigan Supreme Court said you could not do that. That case is also under review.
Without a warrant.
Without a warrant. Yeah, they could have gone to get a warrant, of course.
Does Michigan follow Carroll at all? If you have probable cause to search a car,
there are some Michigan Court of Appeals cases, including some recent ones, that say that they follow Carroll.
What does the Supreme Court of Michigan say?
I can't recall the People versus Hilbert case well enough to know if they even discussed.
Well,
Carroll.
It seems to me if you make that arrest that we just described and then say that you can't search the trunk of the car, you must not follow Carroll.
I don't believe that Michigan does. I just can't recall the opinion in Hilbert well enough to say whether it does or does not.
All three of these fellows were done on the power.
The last point that I'd like to mention briefly is the so-called inventory search. I'm not so sure how much of an issue it is before this court, but my understanding is that there are two requirements for an inventory search. One, there has to be a search, and secondly, there has to be an inventory. If you don't have both ingredients, you don't have an inventory search. This search produced no inventory. When the deputies testified,
I'm not sure I know what you mean when it produced no inventory.
There was no list of the things that were found in the car. When the deputy testified at the trial, he couldn't describe accurately what was in the car. He had a dim recollection of it. If the excuse was that they wanted to protect themselves against claims of theft or intrusion by vandals or that sort of stuff,
they didn't write out a description of items when you say there
yes.
had no inventory?
Yes, they didn't write out a description. The search stopped when they found the marijuana in the trunk. The deputy testified that he had an investigatory motive, and most importantly, he testified that the Berry County Sheriff's Department did not do an inventory search. What he testified at the preliminary examination, there was no standard procedure in their department for inventory searches. It was plainly a ruse, and the Michigan Supreme Court didn't reach that question because they didn't feel that they had to.
May I ask you to—you may be repeating, but you said that as a matter of Michigan law, the search of the trunk would have been improper under the Hilbert case.
I believe that it would have been.
Is that because the presence of marijuana in the car does not establish probable cause to believe there's marijuana in the trunk, or assuming there's probable cause, you still can't open the trunk?
I think it's my recollection of Hilbert is the former, that proving that there's marijuana in the passenger compartment is not probable cause to believe that there is marijuana in the trunk.
And is that a Michigan case based on Michigan law or on federal law?
I wish I'd read it just before I came today. I just really can't recall.
Okay.
I have nothing further than ask the further questions.
Very well. Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll resume arguments at 1 o'clock. That's the kind